I want to thank all the labor unions here in Dane County that help keep SlysOffice.com up and going so you keep up to date, whether it be the Madison Firefighters, Local 311, or the Madison Teamsters, Local 695, or our friends at Madison Teachers Incorporated. These are some of the most active local unions who organize, and constantly stand up for workers. Thank you from SlysOffice.com.
Take the scenic drive to the Guitar Oasis Cool in Jefferson County. Jeff's Guitar Clinic, jeffsguitar.com.
Jeff's Guitar Clinic is a multifaceted shop offering guitars, amplifiers, and all accessories, guitar lessons for all ages, and instrument repair of the highest quality. Take the scenic drive to beautiful Fort Atkinson and see what total customer satisfaction is all about. Call Jeff's Guitar Clinic today at 920-723-1733. That's Jeff's Guitar Clinic at 920-723-1733. Jeffsguitar.com.
Welcome to another podcast at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. Joining us now from the Capital Times, which is turning 100. Amazing. Same year as the Russian Revolution, the Capital Times came along. Comrade John Nichols. Comrade, how are you?
Some people would note that comparison, but truthfully, it was also the same year that World War One went awry and Robert M. La Follette started to take attacks, so we had to start the Capital Times to defend him, and we haven't stopped.
You know, Gomez Adams from the Adams family, I don't know if you ever saw that program. He had a great line. He said that they had their money in the... They had their money in the Tsar Bank of Russia, but they hadn't seen any of it since 1917. I thought that was a good line.
You know, the funny thing is that several of the people involved in the Adams family were old radicals, so they probably did.
I like that show. That was a very funny show. All right, so we've had a lot going on here over the last couple days. So it's good to catch up with you.
Yeah, I don't know how you keep track of it. Yeah.
We'll dive right into it. Here is Al Franken's swan song in the Senate yesterday.
Over the last few weeks, a number of women have come forward to talk about how they felt my actions had affected them. I was shocked. I was upset. But in responding to their claims, I also wanted to be respectful of that broader conversation, because all women deserve to be heard and their experiences taken seriously. I think that was the right thing to do. I also think it gave some people the false impression that I was admitting to doing things that, in fact, I haven't done. Some of the allegations against me are simply not true. Others I remember very differently. You know, an important part of the conversation we've been having the last few months has been about how men abuse their power and privilege to hurt women. I am proud that during my time in the Senate, I have used my power to be a champion of women, and that I've earned a reputation as someone who respects the women I work alongside every day. I know there's been a very different picture of me painted over the last few weeks, but I know who I really am.
Your thoughts about this?
Look, I think it got to a point for Franken where he had laid a marker down. He laid a line down saying, you know, he was willing to go to the ethics committee, have him take a look at it, and quite convinced it would all sort out well for him. That was the initial response. As more folks came forward, right, it wasn't the initial picture, the initial controversy, but as more folks came forward, more women pointing out acts and actions that were concerning, I think that Franken ended up being held to account for the standard that he had set. And his choice to step down was a reflection of that. there's going to be a tremendous amount of debate about this, frankly, among Democrats. And there are going to be some Democrats.
I had a woman come up to me at the grocery store yesterday, and she said, I'm going to be furious if Al Franken steps down. And, of course, I pointed out to her that I disagreed with her. I thought that was a good thing. I posted yesterday that I thought this was an unusually proud moment for someone I don't always agree with. I think she's kind of an interesting senator, and that is Kirsten Gillibrand. Look, she's been at the forefront of this effort in the military, and I think when she said something the other day, that kind of opened the floodgate.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree with you. And I think that you're right. There's going to be a lot of people who are angry with Franken for stepping down. And their anger will be rooted in one side of our politics, which is a sense that when controversy arises, when things get difficult, Democrats stand down where Republicans stand firm. And I heard this, I must have heard it from 50 people yesterday, and overwhelmingly opposing or upset with Franken for stepping down. By the same token, if you look at the arc of history, if you look toward the future, I think you're exactly right that Kirsten Gillibrand has, and a few others, but she, in a very leadership position, has staked out a principled stance that says something that we all say quite often, but we don't always follow through on. And that is that sometimes you got to have a set of values and ideals that rise above the partisan fights of the moment. And some of those values and ideals are related to the treatment of women in professional circumstances, in the military, as Gillibrand has for many, many years emphasized and focused on. And so, again, I know there's people that are going to have a problem with this and you know, in the moment. But I think as we look back on it, I'm hoping that people will see it as a transitional moment in our politics, a point where some standards were set, and ideally that there were rewards for having standards, for taking positions that rose above politics. Now, I don't know if that's going to be the case. I can't guarantee that because, you know, the truth of the matter is we could have a situation on Tuesday, this coming Tuesday, where Roy Moore gets elected to the U.S. Senate from Alabama.
Well, let's.
And then you're going to have a real debate.
I think I think what happened with Franken kind of stunned the Moore defenders. And here's a couple of them, including former Speaker, who is a paragon of virtue, Newt Gingrich. Listen to this and see if you can figure out the game he's playing, because he's always playing a game. That's his MO.
Oh yeah.
All of these nice people, none of whom have given back the money that they raised from Harvey Weinstein, none of whom have repudiated Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton, none of whom seemed offended in the past, suddenly in a paroxysm of moral outrage, create a lynch mob. And what you saw today was a lynch mob. Let's not have due process. Let's not ask anybody any questions. Let's not have any chance to have a hearing. Let's just lynch him, because when we get done lynching him, we'll be so pure.
He's unwilling to fight for his reputation. I happen to think this is a bad decision, and I pretty much don't agree with him on anything. This was a crass political ploy. Democrats dumping Franken overboard because now that they can claim, hey, the moral high ground for 2018 and pursue allegations against Donald Trump and Roy Moore.
She kind of tipped her hand there, didn't she?
Well, a little bit. Here, let's put both these things on the table, right? With all due respect, I'm not sure Newt Gingrich really understands the derivation of the term lynch mob.
Yeah.
Because, in all honesty, what happened with Franken was that he was given an opportunity to make a choice. He could have held on to his seat, at least for a good period of time, maybe through the end of his term. He might have, taken it to the voters. He himself chose to take this action for whatever reason, maybe that he was just, frustrated with it. It may be that he was fearful that more things would come out. Whatever it was, it doesn't matter. He chose to stand down. That's not a lynch mob, right? That's not where you're forced out, you know, unfairly forced to do, you know, to stand down. He did make the choice. He actually, frankly, made a very thoughtful and effective and in fact, pointed statement. And so it's not to say that he didn't face pressure. He did, a lot of pressure, and it was tough. But ultimately, I think that Gingrich is getting, he's hyperventilating about it. He's taking this to a level, very different level than it need be. Well, I wonder, right? And, but then the other thing was even, in many ways, even worse. Because imagine someone saying, well, this is horrible. It's awful that they're doing this. They're trying to claim the moral high ground. Why is it awful to try and claim the moral high ground?
That is a bit perplexing.
What's wrong with that?
That is a bit perplexing. And it is really amazing to watch what's going on in the Alabama Senate race. Steve Bannon decided not to shave or iron his clothes and got up in front of an audience in Alabama, and he decided to go crazy. First on the... He decided to go after the Morning Joe crew, which was kind of a odd thing to do. Here's this.
This post-war, rules-based international order that all the highfalutin people in the Wall Street Journal and the Financial Times of London and on Morning Joe, those geniuses, right? Right? Every day they're on that. They fail to understand that's an inextricably linked network of commercial relationships, trade deals, capital markets, and a security guarantee by guess who? The sons and daughters of this audience.
Whoa.
Okay. Now, you know, I always make the argument that Bannon's the smartest of the bunch.
Uh-huh.
I strongly use these billion times my help. And frankly, you could take the whole Trump cabinet, add all their IQs together, and you'd still be struggling to get in the Bannon zone. And that doesn't make Bannon a genius. He's not as smart as, you know, a lot of other folks, but in this circle. But there you saw a really good example of the old line, I hope I get it right, in the kingdom of the legless, the one-legged man is king. And so... he is the smartest of the community. That wasn't all that sharp a comment, because take a look at what he was saying there. He was saying, in the post-war rules-based international order. Now, as best I can understand it, the reason they put together a post-war rules-based international order was so you didn't have a nuclear war, because that was a pretty bad idea, and maybe even so that you didn't have another world war, which I think would be a pretty bad idea, and also so that colonialism and all sorts of really ugly abuses of humanity, cruel abuses of humanity, might be addressed democratically, small d democratically, without wars. Now,
I always love it when Newt Gingrich says that Barack Obama is an anti-colonialist. I thought, yes.
I am too. And I'll go a step further. I'm an anti-monarchist. I'm not sure I would have given the Queen all those presents. And so the thing of it is here that I fully accept that the post-war rules-based order has often been biased toward the wealthy, toward the elites. But I hope that within that order, we can pressure them and use politics and democracy to undo the power of the elites. Bannon seems to be suggesting is that we ought to abandon that. And then he tells these people, you know, it's protected, defended by your sons and daughters, i.e. people that go into the military. Well, is there anything that Bannon's proposing or that Trump is proposing that makes their sons and daughters safer?
Well, and then that moves on to this. Here is another clip from Bannon.
You went to France to be a missionary while guys were dying in rice paddies in Vietnam. Do not talk to me about honor and integrity. You ran for commander-in-chief. You had 5 sons, not one day of service in Afghanistan and Iraq. We have 7,000 dead and 52,000 casualties. And where were the Romneys during those wars? You have the guts to get on the stage of a man that served in Vietnam, and you expect us to believe honor and integrity? Judge Roy Moore has more honor and integrity in that pinky finger than your entire family has and his whole DNA.
You know, he sounds a little bit like Sam Kinison's professor character in Back to School.
But you know what else? I agree. He also sounds, and this is why Bannon's smart, you know, whether you like him or not, he sounds like an old school Southern politician, like a George Wallace or one of those guys. You know, and it's like these elites, they don't go and serve our kids.
Isn't he from Connecticut?
Well, he's a wealthy man. He used to be with Goldman Sachs. Now, it is important to point out, he did join the military. Remember, he was in military intelligence. He was in the elite side of things because he's a bright guy. But I'm not going to pick on Bannon. Bannon has, you know, he's got his standing. I don't like him, you know, bringing back that George Wallace-style approach to things from the 60s as regards that rhetoric about elites and how they're always out to get you and using that to divide people. However, here's the bottom line on this thing. Is there a single word in what he said, where you couldn't have replaced Romney's with Trump's?
Well, here, and obviously they had a lot of fun with that on television the other day. Here's Joe Scarborough.
Vietnam, in 1968, stood at 6'2", an athletic build. He played football, tennis, squash, golf. His medical history was not blemished.
Loved golf.
Other than he had a routine appendectomy when he was age 10. And yet, Willie Geist, Donald Trump got 5 deferments. Got deferments for bone spurs. And the New York Times reports that on the day he graduated from college, from an Ivy League college after getting 5 deferments, on the day he graduated from college, 40 Americans were killed in Vietnam.
There you go. I'm going to let you respond on the other side because we have to take a break. You're listening to John Nichols here at SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
Hi there, my name is Ishmael Ozan, and many of you know me as the Dane County District Attorney, but I am also a husband and a father of 2 young girls. Today I am asking you to make the choice my wife and I made, to not use physical punishment with our children. Many of us are not aware that over 16 years ago, the American Academy of Pediatrics urged doctors to recommend that parents not use physical punishment on their children. Today, over 100 years of research on children and families supports this recommendation. Look, well-meaning parents may use physical discipline intending to teach their children to make good choices, but we now know that physical discipline actually leads to more disobedience and aggressive behaviors in children. We all want what is best for our kids. Today, we now know what is best for kids is parenting based on respect, mutual understanding, and logic, rather than fear of physical pain. Please join me in learning more about positive parenting and creating a violence-free home.
Paid for by the Dane County District Attorney's Office with support from UW Health American Family Children's Hospital.
We're back at SliceOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers. John Nichols from the Capital Times. All right, obviously Scarborough was all ready for that one. When in fact, he had those statistics about the president and his war service. And this leads to my next question. Did you get a chance to see Donald Trump with the survivors of Pearl Harbor yesterday?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Well, go ahead.
Trump's, I was just going to say, just to point out, just in perspective, Trump started the day off by misquoting Franklin Roosevelt.
Well, and that's why
he actually got.
Yeah, that's why we get to this. Yeah. This is Brian Williams.
This was Pearl Harbor Day, and if you're the leader of this nation, it's hard to screw up Pearl Harbor Day. It's the day we salute the sacrifice of those killed in the sneak attack by Japan. We mourn the dead. We salute the survivors. We mark the U.S. entry into World War II. This day in history later defined America as the dominant power in the modern world. Yet, despite all that I just said, the president and first lady both managed to get it wrong today. The first lady on Twitter got the date wrong by a month, later corrected. The president got FDR's quote wrong. It was a date which will live in infamy. Then came time for the president to host some Pearl Harbor survivors.
As we remember that fateful day, it's an incredible honor to be joined here with surviving veterans of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And you'll be here for the next 7 years with me, okay? All right, 7 years. After that, who knows? You saw something that few people have ever witnessed before, right?
Right.
Amazing. Thanks, Mickey. You look like you're about 50 years old. Huh? You must have been very young. It was pretty wild scene. You'll never forget that, right?
Wild scene, huh? I've never heard Pearl Harbor described as a wild scene.
Wild scene.
That's sort of beatnick vernacular.
Your waitresses, right?
Yeah.
You sound like a nightclub singer, though, right? Get him here the next 7 nights.
Yeah, I think Donald Trump was at the Sands with Sammy Davis Jr. and Dean Martin.
but it was shtick. I mean, he was up there doing the nightclub singer or the comedian, and kind of bringing the audience. Yeah, you don't look under 50. That was a wild scene. Hey, you remember this little ditty? you're talking about, there was nothing solemn. There was nothing thoughtful about it all. You have not been to the Pearl Harbor Memorial, have you?
Bye. You're asking me? No, I have not.
I've been there a number of times. And my dad was a kid from Oshkosh, Wisconsin, who, finished high school early to volunteer during World War II to serve. And he would be, this is today when we're taping this, he'd be 90 years old today. And that's a remarkable thing because my dad was one of the youngest guys to sign up during World War II. He's toward the later stages in the war. And so everybody we're talking about, everybody who's at Pearl Harbor, they're well over 90. They're in the mid-90s. They are the living memory of incredible sacrifice. What they experienced at Pearl Harbor launched the United States after struggle on the issue, question of whether to enter into World War II, launched the United States into World War II, not merely against the Japanese, but against global fascism. And that less than four-year struggle, find the United States in the modern age as the unquestionable superpower, to be clear, but also as a force that was willing to organize international coalitions against totalitarian threats, not just to the United States, but also to the rest of the world. And so when you go to that memorial, right, if you have even the slightest sense of history, and also the slightest sense of personal connection to American history, to all of the world, like what you would hope a president of the United States would have. I just have to tell you, I have never been anywhere near that memorial where I haven't been, just profoundly moved. And you just can't, you don't find many jokes when you're there.
Well, the fact that he prefaced that those men should be around another 7 years, he's evidently thinks he can take his 32% approval rating and turn it into reelection. He built it around himself. And then he goes, after that, like they would just be discarded because he wouldn't need them for props anymore.
You're on your own.
Yeah. That mindset is narcissism just oozing out of him. It's just absolutely remarkable.
I don't think, with all due respect to the language, I think narcissist is, I don't think it's a sufficient word for this. I think there are narcissists who are like really, like people are obsessed with everything they do, can only talk about themselves the whole bit, who are saying, yeah, but I'm not that. You know, because Trump is, I mean, the worst narcissist in the world, the most intense narcissist in the world, but get up and say, wow, I am feeling really moved here today. Or I am, you know, I can't begin to tell you all the things that are going through my head. But that's not what Trump's doing. Trump is literally, you know, using these solemn events as marketing. Right? You know, like, by the
like
way,
he's selling Trump steaks.
I don't know if I formally announced for re-election, but I will be around for the next 7 years.
There have been some
amazing thing.
There have been some incredible developments in the Russia probe, and Sean Hannity and Laura Ingraham and Newt Gingrich, they all have the long knives out for Robert Mueller. But Jeff Greenfield said something a couple days ago that I thought was interesting, and I wanted to get your take on what Greenfield said, because, you know, this is something I know we focus on, but I think there's probably a portion of the country that's just maybe focused on other things. Here's what Jeff Greenfield said.
Impeachment is fundamentally a political issue, and it is entirely possible, given the conditions we're in now, that when and if Mueller were able to put something on the table that looked like clear obstruction of justice, the response on Capitol Hill would be from some fake news, it's all partisan, everybody does it. The notion, I think people are locked in a kind of a Watergate frame, and they're viewing everything through a prism, which in my view, politically, has fundamentally changed. And the last thing I'll say about that is, again, it's hard for Trump's critics to accept this. His side is winning, despite his historic unpopularity, amazing radical changes. The dream on the right for years, they are coming true. And so the idea that a Mueller finding is going to automatically trigger, well, that's it, move up the Santini Brothers moving van, I think is misplaced.
Your thoughts on his statement?
I think he's totally right. I continue to be a passionate advocate for impeachment. I think the impeachment proceedings should begin now. I think that...
Well, the vote was... Wasn't that vote interesting the other day?
Well, no. It showed you the full spine of the Democratic Party.
Well, no, but did you see... Did you see the majority of the people who voted not to table the impeachment were African-American members?
Of course they were. Of course. You know, because they see the broader, and Latinos and a few, you know, white members, notably, in many cases, folks who represent diverse communities. They see this as it should be seen. Because you know what? When an African-American person does something wrong, they're held to account. They get the full force of the law thrown at them. When a poor person gets in trouble, they're held to account. They get the full force of law and all, every vehicle to sanction them is thrown at them. But when a billionaire grifter who's lousy at business and gets bailed out by all of his, you know, global elite buddies and, you know, whatever oligarch wants to give him a loan, when that guy gets in trouble, then suddenly, oh, there's ideologies and there's partisanships and there's all sorts of other things that have to come first. And so I, with the folks who voted for impeachment the other day, I think they were right. I support what they were doing. I think the time is correct. But I also think that Jeff Greenfield is speaking truth. And this is something to understand. The Republican Party at this point is getting what it wants, because the Republican Party is a conservative party. And, you know, I've got very little taste for all these so-called never-Trump conservatives, right? These people say, well, I believe in a lot of these things. I just don't like Trump personally. But you know what the truth of the matter is? You're about to get a test on that, right? Because the Republican poll of the House and the Senate, if they don't like Trump, they could start impeaching him today. They could get him. You know, you understand, if you take down Trump and his, you know, sidekick, lawless sidekick Mike Pence, took both of them down. They could put their buddy Paul Ryan in as president of the United States. They could do that. They're not going to. I'll tell you why they won't. Because they don't want to upset the apple cart. They know that Trump brings them an extreme base of support that's very, very important in their congressional districts. And they're rolling right now. They are deregulating. They are redistributing wealth upwards. They are restructuring the future of this country. And I think they will resist a lot of revelations. And that is, to my mind, why the issue of the 2018 election should be, do you hold these people to account?
Would it be similar to the Party
won't rise to that.
Would it be similar to the relationship between Wahhabism and radicals in Saudi Arabia and the Saudi family?
I would defer to a wiser analyst such as yourself on that issue.
That just popped into my head.
More,
I thought, well, you know there is a marriage. There's a marriage of convenience in Saudi Arabia, right?
Marriage of convenience. I'll go a little lower. I'll just go a little more local.
Okay.
Chicago machine, 1950s, right? You know, it's political machine, and at the end of the day, if you're in power and things are working, you defer to the boss, right? No matter how bad the boss is, no matter how foul a character, doesn't matter. And you even create a mythology about the boss, right? Oh, you know, he's really a nice guy, lives in a nice neighborhood, you know, blah, blah, blah. You know, this is what they're doing with Trump. They may acknowledge some of his flaws and things like that, but at the end of the day, I think that what's ugly here, what's cruel and awful, is conservatism. Now, I don't think conservative ideology, I love people are sincere in their ideology and want to have a debate about it, but I think there are corporate, in this case, corporate conservatives, right? Not true conservatives, not people who really believe in a set of principles, but corporate conservatives who've taken over the Republican Party, and they are willing to enter into a marriage of convenience with Donald Trump to advance their economic agenda.
All right, see if you like this quote.
And this is an ugly scene.
Okay. Here's what I put on Facebook the other day. Okay? Our country has been commandeered by a group of contemptible, rapacious liars. You like that?
Did you get any pushback on that?
No.
You get any pushback?
Nope.
I wouldn't think so, because that sounds about right. You know, except you're using very, very sophisticated language there, son.
Well, I learned from the best.
Impressed.
John Nichols. Yeah? John Nichols. John Nichols, congratulations to the Capital Times turning 100.
Thank you, brother. I really appreciate it. And we'll continue to keep struggling. You've been a part of the story now for the better part of 20, 25 years. So thank you.
And so it goes. John Nichols from the Capital Times at SlysOffice.com, brought to you by the United Steelworkers.
SlysOffice.com.
Thanks a million.
Bye-bye.
Making stuff matters, because when we make things in America, America makes it. American workers and families make it. Our communities make it. Consider this. For every one manufacturing job in our communities, 5 more jobs are supported. Manufacturing jobs pay an average of 10 to 50% more than service sector jobs. That allows working families to support their local businesses, schools, emergency services, and more. Creating 2.5 million new manufacturing jobs would mean at least $100 billion for our economy over the next decade. Domestic manufacturing is the green economy. It's among the cleanest, most efficient, and productive in the world. That's why the United Steelworkers and our more than 1 million members and retirees are fighting so hard to protect and grow manufacturing. Because making stuff really does matter. Join our fight. Visit usw.org and like us at facebook.com/steelworkers. Support American manufacturing. Buy American. Buy Union.